This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
In 1952, the height of the Cold War, the BBC offered a 43-year-old philosophy professor named Isaiah Berlin the opportunity to give 6-hour-long lectures on the radio on the subject of freedom. These talks were completely unscripted. Berlin talked completely extemporaneously, the way I'm doing, filled exactly his hour each week. And he chose as his theme freedom and its betrayal, how ideas and philosophies of liberation so often have turned into their opposite, and that the greatest tyrants often start out as the great liberators. His prime examples were the French and Russian revolutions. And he wanted to examine 6 philosophers from the late 18th and early 19th century who he believed set some of these disasters in motion. So the BBC gives him this prime time to do what he wants with, and he announces the first lecture is going to be on Helvetius. Can you imagine? You know, you've just given this guy freedom to talk about anybody he wants, and he picks somebody no one has ever heard of, right? Helvetius being a 18th century forerunner of Bentham, someone who was first articulated principles of utilitarianism. He then went on to do an hour on Rousseau, who I thought was particularly interesting, because Rousseau is generally thought of as the very embodiment of freedom. Rousseau sort of thought that it was the essence of our human nature to be free, to have choice. And he intended himself to be a great liberator, and yet he became one of the inspirations of the French Revolution. Berlin particularly focused, though, on how Rousseau dealt with the problem of individual freedom and how it relates to the general political will. How do you form a society of free individuals? How do you find some way to balance all that individual freedom without things just dissolving into anarchy? And Rousseau describes how he came to a solution to this problem, and he says he was completely caught up in the dilemma of the apparent contradiction between individual freedom and the need for rules to govern society. And it seemed like an insoluble kind of koan-like either or. And Rousseau says as he was walking down the road one day, it suddenly hit him in a flash what the solution was. And it was like a bolt of lightning hit him. And he was just dissolved in laughter and tears and the realization and solution of the problem. You know, in another context, it would sound like a great enlightenment experience. And his solution was indeed one that seems very koan-like, because he said that what he realized was that the solution to the problem with freedom was the dissolving of the individual will, individual freedom, into the collective will of society. And that when we understand our true nature, when we understand how we are all intrinsically rational and good, then we see that what we would desire for ourselves and what we desire in a society will be perfectly identical, and there'll be no conflict at all. See, the dilemma, he thought, is when we don't know our true nature, and that we end up in the incoherent pursuit of pleasures instead of the good, and individual desires instead of the collective good of society. And Berlin felt that this was a radical turning point in the philosophy of freedom, because suddenly freedom was able to mean its exact opposite. Because once you identify freedom with the good of the whole, then any means is justified in bringing that about. And that once you say that people don't know their true nature, once you say that people are often ignorant of the good, and it's the job of a political or philosophical or religious elite to organize things so that it will bring them into the harmony with society, even if that's a harmony that they're not quite yet aware that they desire. Once they're in that state of oneness with society, they will realize the error of their ways and be grateful for having been brought into line with their true self. Now, I think that it is relevant to us to look at the kinds of parallels this has to so many religious leaders and practices, and you know, in an extreme version, it doesn't sound very different from the kind of thing that, you know, may have just seen in the documentary about Rajneesh, where a guru with a blinding insight into how society and personality needs to be restructured creates first a commune and then an ever larger society dedicated to freedom, but a freedom that becomes more and more dependent on the use of force to maintain itself. Now, Zen, like, you know, many religious practices, has an idea that there is something like a true self or Buddha nature that we are blinded to by our own self-centered preoccupations. And it is the role of practice to get us in touch with our true nature and get us in some way free us from a false sense of what counts as freedom. I used to say that beginning a sesshin was like taking a step onto an escalator. All you had to choose to do was take that first step, and the escalator would carry you along, right? And that what a sesshin does for you is eliminate the tyranny of individual choice and likes and dislikes, and says, just do the next thing. Sit till you hear the bell. Walk till you hear the clappers. Have meals in this prescribed way according to a particular set of rituals. Let yourself forget about your own likes and dislikes for a little while. Let yourself just be carried along and feel the liberation that comes from not having to decide what you're going to do, when, for how long, whether you like it, whether you don't like it. Let yourself simply be present to what's next. Now, it's certainly possible that when you let yourself simply be immersed in a form, there is a great relaxation into that. Right? You just, it's one of the things we mean by just sit, right? You don't have to decide anything. You don't even have to do it right or wrong. You're just sitting there, allowing the moment to unfold. But it's certainly possible that, you know, when people first encounter this, or we can feel sometimes, even after many years, that the form can feel like a straitjacket, right? It can feel like, you can't tell me to sit there, you can't tell me what to do. Why should I sit here if I'm feeling restless or in pain? Well, that's just torture or masochism, right? Where does it cross a line? When does freedom become its opposite? See, one of the things practice is predicated on is the sense that the rules of sesshin are not going to do anything more painful to you than you're already doing to yourself. That the real tyranny is the tyranny of your own self-centered criticism, your own self-hate, your own tyrannical self-improvement project. Your own sense of always having something wrong with you, of always needing improvement, of always being a day late or a dollar short. And that's the tyranny that one way or another everybody's already living under. And so the first work of therapy or a kind of Zen practice like this is a kind of awareness or uncovering of the rules of the tyranny that you impose on yourself already. And I've often described it as a kind of self-hate, with one part of the self attacking the other and calling the whole thing spirituality. See, we all have to come to terms with what counts as an actual liberation in our life. Dogen suggests that a particular form of life is the expression of our true nature, a life of zazen and ritual and monasticism. This is what it's most like to be fully human. To give yourself over to this form is to be liberated in the deepest sense. And yet the lesson that Berlin wants to draw from these various liberators turned tyrants is the sense that any form, when it's applied as sort of a one-size-fits-all solution, can turn into the opposite of its original intention. Sesshin may be very liberating for some and simply torture for others. But there is something about the image of the escalator that I think is important for our daily life, because it says that in some sense we are simply being carried through our life moment after moment. There is a kind of inevitability about the next moment that we simply show up to. And that moment is not something we can predict or control. What we can do in our practice is be free to fully be aware, fully experience it, and respond in the best way we know how. But we won't have freedom by trying to jump off the escalator or to dismantle it. One way or another, we're going to have to go for this ride and see where it takes us. And the freedom that we have is a constantly shifting balance between complete acceptance of what's next and complete freedom about how to respond to it.